Welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. We are one of more than two dozen lodges on most continents around the world. We are dedicated to spread broadcasting the original teachings unadulterated as they were recorded in the latter part of the 19th century by H.P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge. So we want to remind everyone we are meeting on Sundays for the rest of the month, but we do not meet in August. It's time for rest, relaxation, and study at your own pace. So the doors open on Sundays at 10:30. And the meeting begins promptly at 11 and ends promptly at 12. So we're doing letters this month from Letters That Have Helped Me by William Q. Judge. Today we're doing Coping with Despair, which is letter 5 on page 7. Now, on Wednesdays, we had the intro to the Bhagavad Gita, and we are beginning chapter 2?
Continuing.
Oh, we already started? Okay. Well, we had the intro, and I guess we went through chapter 1 and part of chapter 2. It said, really, that chapter 2 is the most important chapter in the entire book. And if that's all we had to work with, we probably would have enough for this lifetime and many others. But, of course, the whole poem is wonderful. And it's even good to hear chanted in Sanskrit, because we may not understand the language, but we can still pick up the vibration. And It's also an adjunct. It's a good thing to do if you can. So, we have no dues or fees. We have, you know, we are an association of students. But as we can see, there's things happening around this building. And for sure, it's saying, help me, please help me. So any contributions are certainly welcome, because this is our meeting place. This is what we have, and we really do need to maintain it. So we will read the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists right now. And also, there are many volunteer opportunities on the bulletin board where you can't enter the library for now until it's fixed, but on the outside of the library door adjacent to the book table, pretty much wide open for volunteers throughout the summer. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution nor bylaws nor officers. The sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. So, as I said, we are on letter 7, which there's a handout, or of course the book, which is page 5 in the book. And we're going to have, even though it's a very short letter, we're going to have the highlights summarized, and then of course the entire letter is open for discussion. And after it is summarized, we will have discussion at this time. Oh, page 7 is letter, sorry, letter 5. Sorry. It says page 1 here, it's confusing me.
Well, we look at this letter, it's very short, but it certainly is full of many good ideas, and it was interesting to us to read it because when we're looking at the idea of despair, theosophy looks at it in a very different light. The letter starts out where Mr. Judge is almost like he's apologizing because he felt as though he wasn't good enough to answer this person's letter. But he goes on to say, though, just because we have this inability to help someone doesn't mean that we shouldn't do it, because as he says, whatever comes our way is ours to do. And no matter how inadequate we feel doing these actions, as long as we're doing our best, that's enough. And that we shouldn't compare ourselves with other people that about how another would do it. That we shouldn't, because then we're comparing, and that can just make us more, you know, despair even more. He says our only right is in the act itself. So by doing our best, that is good enough. And this was kind of an interesting part too. He goes about having knowledge about something can create despair. By knowing something or having an idea about what is going on, he says sadness is less than the joy of truth. So knowing the truth about something can lead to despair, but it can also lead to hope. And we are not the only ones who suffer along the path. The masters have also suffered and have had despair along their path as well. And what he quotes, "Do you suppose we have not passed through many times worse trials than you think you are in?" And along the path of the true student is sadness. But there is also joy and hope. Sadness comes from a more than just appreciation of the difficulties in one's way and of the great wickedness of individual and collective part of man. So this is, we think this is an explanation of what he was meaning about having knowledge can create despair. Because when we look at the world, when we look at the difficulties that we have, and we see that these difficulties are ours, this is the truth, and sometimes it can lead to despair. But the awareness of it can also lead to hope. And the elder brothers, he says they do exist, that they were meant to, and that there are even those above them that have been along this path as well and have had their despair and their sadness about the truth that they have seen. And even though these elder brothers, the higher ones, are no longer with us, there's that trickle-down effect that we still feel their effect through the masters that are helping us. So at the very end, he says, don't be anxious and don't get maddened. And he has that in quotes. Because if we get mad, if we get upset, then we can get anxious. And the law does not take into account anything that we are doing or our desire to go ahead or behind. He says, if we are anxious, we are raising a barrier against progress. So the whole idea with despair is that we are just holding ourselves back. And by knowing the truth, that even though it may not be a very happy existence that we are seeing, it is still the truth, and it is still something that we need to accept.
We don't ever remember this being a topic of discussion for a meeting here. It could have been before my time, certainly. But coping with despair, we were reading a lot of things about humor this morning because that is definitely one way to cope with despair. Do we have any comments?
Yeah, it would seem that this letter is a wonderful tool for the times in which we live. If we look at that last sentence on the first side, sadness comes from a more just appreciation of the difficulties in one's way and of the great wickedness of the individual and collective heart of man. The times in which we live surround us in the astral with incredible despair, anxiety, etc., etc. And this is a tool, rather than tuning into that collectivity, to detach from it.
So rather than tuning in, we detach. We recognize its existence. We don't deny it. It's certainly all around us. But yet, we can become very depressed if we just think about these, all the negativity in the world. And the truth is that the collective whole, that there's hope there. There's always hope. There's one concept here that we've never come across before. We often hear about that there's a guru parampara chain from the lowest to the highest, but we often talk about the brothers, but here it mentions the fathers, which are that we can get if we are living the life of purity, we can certainly benefit from that, and it flows through the masters and to us. So the term fathers is an interesting one, we think, and we don't know if there's any other references. Yes.
Well, when it speaks of the early humanity and how we were instructed by higher beings, those are the fathers, and they taught us and impressed on us certain innate ideas. Then they depart, and it becomes the effort of that whole group. So their influence is always felt by us, even if we don't recognize it. But we wanted to also say about reacting to despair, that great line from The Light of Asia, I booed who wept with all my brother's tears, laugh and am glad, for there is liberty. And we think that's the best tonic to despair, is to recognize there is truth and hope and light and love and goodness always win.
Yes.
A good friend and a companion on the path recently said some very wise words, and I overheard that upon awakening and feeling pain or anxiety or illness in the morning, thoughts were turned instead to all the conditions to be grateful for: a roof, food, bed to sleep in, you know, all of the necessities of life that remain available and ongoing, so we can move through these trials. And it just struck me as a very, very wise but very practical and down-to-earth practice that can be done when despair hits.
Yes, it's sort of like shaving. It's shaving away all the things that are really not necessary, and being grateful for what you have. And even if you have nothing, even if you're homeless, you do have a chance. You do have, you know, it's a temporary condition, or maybe they don't know. Maybe they really are despairing, but by just a smile or a kind word, that can make their day. Yes, in the back.
We read a wonderful quote. We'll paraphrase it. It's, whenever you're unhappy or in despair over the things that you wanted that you didn't get, stop and remember all the things you didn't want that you didn't get.
Right, and we also may want something really badly when we're younger, and then when we're older, we realize that it's frivolous, but then we may get it anyway, and it could be a burden. In the back?
Well, we just found that this whole idea of the awareness of truth, do not let the sadness of knowledge create despair. The sadness is less than the joy of truth. And we kept thinking about that, you know, that having knowledge can make you sad.
Well, we think that people that are in powerful positions have more knowledge of what's going on behind the scenes, and that can make them saddened. So, knowledge. But it's not the reality. It's more knowledge of circumstances and conditions, but it's not more knowledge of universal principles. So what makes us saddened is knowing just how perverse or twisted certain groups or organizations are, and they're hell-bent on destruction, we'll just say. But that's not, you know, that's not the reality. Yes.
But even that should give us a pause and stop for
why does that group act as they are acting, and trace it backwards, and you can see there was a sincere thing at the very beginning, and how things get twisted and turned on themselves, and hate is love upside down sort of thing. So we think it can be very educational and make us watch our own motives.
It's great to read history and you know, various people's histories and from alternative points of view. You had your hand up, and then you had your hand up.
Yeah, the thought occurred that if there's no sense, there's no pain. If we detach and we pull away from the awareness of the knowledge that we can get on the internet or all sorts of electronic media, and we focus instead on the wisdom of the eternal, we're more centered and therefore more ready to be able to help and assist. And the second thought was that there's a very interesting article that appeared in Psychology Today in 1972, written by Dr. David McClellan, and I'm pretty sure it can be found on the internet, but it was entitled Love and Power, the Psychological Signals of War. And it was quite a study, and it echoes what was just said immediately before, in that reformers with very pure love in their hearts move from the reform movement into frustration, into lunatic fringe, into violence. And it's an interesting read to help us understand and feel compassion for other souls who are on the path of life.
Yes. Violence, of course, doesn't solve anything, but it does seem like a solution to many. When people are desperate, then they'll literally try anything. You had your hand up.
One thing we think that helps in this whole scenario is the recognition from a theosophical perspective that there is no God that's making this happen in retribution, but rather everything that's happening is the result of what we've done as a humanity, and we're in our own soup for ourselves. So if we are incarnated, in whether it's our own particular conditions or just in these worldly conditions, if we bear in mind that the law is working in its divine way, and, you know, we just think it makes a lot of sense not to despair and get caught up in it and get anxious, because that just causes blocks. So then maybe we should help ourselves to prepare for it by realizing either I'm here in these conditions as a victim of my own self, and at least you're empowering yourself, or I'm here in these conditions and it's really not affecting me as much as it's affecting a lot of the other people, so I'm in a position somewhere, somehow, to be of help. Either way, we have to look at it as the divine condition, the divine law in operation, and we're responsible, rather than being the victim of judgment of a
right.
greater being.
Yeah, Mr. Judge, one of his many helpful statements was, you know, it's not the conditions, it's we who are the variants. We can vary. The conditions are pretty constant, and they return in cycles, but it's we are the variants. Yes.
What does it mean? We heard this sentence, okay, from one of the teachers. Necessity is the mother of invention.
Well, simply, it's when the need arises, we can rise up and find a creative solution out of it. It could be a situation we've never given any thought to, whatsoever. That could be a follow-up?
Yes. Along with that, there was a statement, every failure is success. Repeat the failures and become full of success.
That's a good statement. Yes, I mean, it's the ones who are successful are the ones that are undaunted by the trials and tribulations and the failures and the and also the public opinion, family opinion. It can be, it really can be overwhelming. Maybe that's why there's so few people that really, so few individuals that really stand out. And but we're told to, you know, to stand out and to be separate in a sense. I mean, as far as not following the crowd, not that we're to be separate, that we're different from other people, because we're not. Yes?
If we may just give an example, during World War II, some of us never could swim. We were in the Navy. Took us on a 20-foot tower and said, "Phil, he must be out of his mind." And when he didn't jump, he put his foot in our back and away we went. Well, after being pulled out of the water so many times, you eventually began to invent waves. So much so that you didn't have to jump in and pull you out.
Well, we may never learn to be good swimmers, but if we can tread water well, and really that's the key, to tread water until the help comes or the idea comes or the solution comes. We're allegorically in life. Just treading water goes a long way. And then maybe we can swim to the other shore. I mean, in Mr. Judge's story, it's famous for his persistence as a lad, how he, you know, was able to sink and jump and sink and, but you know, but okay, yes, in the back. Sure. Is it on despair or is it more cheerful?
The next to the last paragraph, the very tiny one, talks about faith. What is faith? It's the intuitional feeling that is true. We've talked about faith in class before, but this just seems to really explain faith very well, even though it's just two sentences. Formulate to yourself certain things as true that you feel to be true and increase your faith in them.
Well, it sounds like, as we say here, we go from universals and then the particulars. So we do. We have to believe in something. I mean, we really would be full of despair if we didn't believe in anything or anyone, and that we're just here, we're just a fluke. And I mean, there are individuals like that, and they're really in living hell. They're in a living hell. But we have to intuitionally have a feeling that this is true, just because it has been repeated again and again and again, not only in our lives, but in the lives of others, whether known or unknown, famous or unfamous. So we work from there. We look at these universals, and if we feel them to be true, then we test them, check, and verify their truth, and move on from there. But this is faith. This is not just belief. There's a difference. I mean, so many people say, "I believe in this" or "I believe in that," and it's just because they've been told to believe, and they do believe because that's their system. They're not really thinking. They're not testing. They're not checking things out. They're just, it's the blind leading the blind is what it is. And the bench in the back there.
Treading water. If we didn't believe we could hang on in this despair that we're going through, in this case, we would drown.
Right, right.
Or in general despair.
Yes, yeah, so treading water is not surrender. It's you know, it's an active process, and sometimes in life we can't immediately change our situation, but we work through it to the best of our ability, and we realize that if we can realize that this is not reality, this is just a condition, and that it will pass, that we are not our bodies, we're not our circumstances, we're not our thoughts, our feelings, we're none of that, that we're greater than that, then we can move on beyond that. Yes.
It says in the, I guess in the second page, it says, look at the great fountain of hope and of joy. When we consider ourselves in great despair, we've lost all hope. Not that we even lost faith, we just lost hope. And once we begin to, I think, reconsider the ideas of reincarnation and karma, and everything is put into perspective. And our, you know, we begin to see a larger picture, and we then the despair doesn't seem so finite, because if we all experience despair, we know when we see the television and the amount of suffering going on in the world, refugees moving from continent to continent, you know, despair is out there.
Well, chapter one, which we just covered in the Bhagavad Gita, is the despondency of Arjuna. So what's the correlation between despondency and despair? Are they synonymous or not? Yes.
Well, the correlation between the two might be, well, they're close, but we think that despair is more giving up and giving in. And despondency is, you know, what is going on here? It's not working, you know? So, but despondency is not a bad thing, because all it says is that you've been trying and you haven't gotten the results you expect, but you know, it's not a reason to stop trying. So often we hear, you know, we hear of, okay, cycles. We hear of, oh, well, a cycle is, you know, the beginning of it is the creation, the end of it is the destruction. Well, just as sacred is Vishnu, is the maintenance of the cycle. Just as sacred is whether or not you are despondent. If you continue to try, what does that take? It takes the strength of the inner man. It takes virtue. It takes character. It takes persistence. It takes the inner faculties of faith to continue to maintain. You know, Vishnu may be a god to be worshipped, so to speak, because without it, well, the next step is destruction. And we can say, well, we know the knowledge of cycles is always going to lead to destruction. That's how wise we are. No, that doesn't take wisdom. Wisdom applied is the maintenance of a good thing, or letting something self-destruct if it's not helpful.
So, if we're despondent, then we're not really responding to the situation. We're retreating from it. And as long as the retreat is, if we retreat and regroup and then react and respond, that's fine. But if we get caught up in a cycle of despondency, then we're heading for despair. So, despondency, it's almost like, all right, I don't want to be here. I don't want to accept this. I'm forgetting all about the law of karma, forgetting about the law, karma. I don't want to be a part of that law. I don't like that law. Well, it's too bad. We need to regroup and respond. Otherwise, we're just headed for a downward cycle. Yes. Okay, and then you. Yes, you, and then you. Go ahead, in the back.
Me?
Up against the wall there.
One good thing about the literature that we can pick up on the table and in the letters.
Could you speak up a little bit?
One good thing is the literature that we have on the table in the library, and this part of the letters that have taught me very good, because Mr. Judge somewhere, I think it was him, said that a bunch of boys, his boyhood friends, they were not even adults yet, jumped in the creek to swim across. He couldn't swim. But he did jump in, walked a ways, come up, took a deep breath, and sank to the bottom again, walked a little further, came up, took a nap. And when he reached the other side, all his friends cheered him for his effort. He didn't quit. He came up with the idea. And that example has stuck with us for a minute. He walked a ways, come up, took a deep breath, went back down, walked through. So it fits in with that idea of invention.
But it wouldn't work in the ocean, would it now?
Well, in the ocean, you don't have to worry. The problem is so great, all you have to do is get on the back.
Okay. Yes. You had your hand up.
Well, on the idea of despondency and despair, we know that when we're despondent, we're not really plugged in. We're not here. We're not there. You know, we're just sort of like giving up, or you know, we bothered anymore, and that goes on for a while, and then after a while, you begin despairing because nothing is happening. Everything is staying the same, and it just goes on and on and on. So those ideas are brother and sister, or mother and father, I don't know. But we all are Arjuna. We all have that. We don't want to fight. We don't want to take on that part of our nature that we have cultivated. You know, that we, I've gotten this far, but through the use of our personalities and certain traits, and now we come here and we're saying, gee whiz, we need to control that. It's been in control all this time. And now we're asked to be mindful of how we speak and how we act and how we think.
And like Arjuna, those things that we're fighting are near and dear to us. They're our own defects, faults, whatever you want to call them, quirks that we've become comfortable with and that are difficult to change. So, but if we don't change, the cycle will continue. It'll roll on. They won't stop until the necessity ceases, and the necessity does not cease until the lesson is learned. So it says here that in occultism, the law takes no account of our projects and objects or our desire to be ahead or behind. Now, let's think about that, because in occultism, that we're dealing with a whole different plane of being and action. It's beyond all the. It's metaphysical. It's beyond the physical. And the law takes no account of what we want or what we don't want, or if we want to be ahead or behind. It's said that that the disciple shall covet is to appear as nothing in the eyes of men. And it runs completely counter to our culture, because we're just to be happy without getting anything that we work for or anything we desire. We can be happy that way? That sounds crazy. And maybe a lot of people will read this and say, these people, they don't know what they're talking about. So do we know what we're talking? Does Mr. Judge know what he's talking about here? Yes.
Well, I think we all can agree upon one idea, that we're all selfish. All right? It's just a matter of to what degree and in what direction. But each one of us are. We're in a society where selfishness is part of the culture, and that if we do not think we possess any of that,
Well, we can't speak for everyone else about the degree of selfishness or non-selfishness, but there are always examples of people who are unselfish that we need to aspire to. In the back.
Well, perhaps another way to understand what was just said is that as soul, as spirit, we have the purest of attributes, and we are working through a human condition that shares certain potentiality with the collective, and the experience may be one of selfishness, but we are not selfish. We are experiencing that, both by watching others and by living our own lives. But it's important to use the correct terms, otherwise we're in a containment that's just not true.
So we hope that selfishness is one of the many conditions that we are working through, because we are pure spiritual beings. We are gods, really. We're not realizing our potential at this point, and we've forgotten because we've gotten enmeshed in matter and, like they say, sex, security, and society. We look at those three, and we desire them, and we want to get ahead, and we want to succeed, and it's but it's a downward cycle. It's something that that we need to work through. We came from spirit. We came from the highest level, and we've involved ourselves, and we've passed the midway point of evolution, and now we're evolving. But we have this. We are spiritual beings. We see many examples of people that they're completely selfless, and maybe it takes a certain situation, as earlier stated, necessity is the mother of invention. People can find great strength. They can summon great strength that they never knew they had in certain situations. Over here, yes.
I have a question.
Okay.
What part, when you talk about being selfish, what part does materialism play in that? You know?
What part does materialism?
Yeah.
Well, we think that materialism plays a huge part in being selfish because it's the desire for things. It's covetousness. It's it's desiring things above all else.
So without materialism, is there really, what type of impact does selfishness have?
Okay, if there is no materialism, then there can be spiritual selfishness and pride as well. So, yeah, it moves to another level. That's the interesting thing about the Bhagavad Gita and the voice of this silence. It takes you step through step, and it changes. It's like a chameleon, I guess. It just changes its stripes and colors and becomes something else, but it's still there. Until it's finally eradicated, but that's a very long and difficult process. Yes?
Well, the idea of selfishness is inherent in the great heresy of separateness. Okay? That's also where despair comes from, this feeling of separateness. So that no one's saying that selfishness is good or bad. It's a process that we all have to learn and go through. And it's like everything else in our life, we get attached to it because it brings us certain results. So, nothing is good or bad. It's everything's that we experience, and we take from it what we can. But to know the truth is that selfishness on the material plane is one thing, and as you mentioned, pride and selfishness on the spiritual plane is another thing as well. So, really, the ideas that we hold.
Yes, it's the ideas that we hold, and that's a trap. Often, the ideas that we hold, they can be it can be a trap or it can be liberating. I mean, totally liberating. The key to bliss, really. Is this a follow up?
Yeah, well, I mean, the dichotomy is we're here. We're trying to uncover some of these truths that we keep on hearing have an inherent magnetic quality, that have an inherent power. So that's why we come. We're trying to understand what these truths mean and how we can incorporate them into our life to make us stronger and make us better able to help and teach others. You know, I mean, we can memorize and learn all kinds of things, but it doesn't mean we understand them.
Yes, that's why we gather together, to help us to better understand how to help and teach others. That's why we're here. That, and of course, the bottom line is no separateness, universal brotherhood. In the back?
The last paragraph where that one portion says, the law takes no account of our projects and objects or our desire to be ahead or behind. This is an interesting statement because we wonder if this is another way of explaining what evolution is, because the law will bring to us the situations that we warrant, the situations that will help us by our reactions to grow, the lessons that we learn. So if the law brings that to us, it doesn't really care how we, well, I guess it would, I mean, how we respond to it by those projects and objects. It's just kind of an interesting way of stating it.
The law, by its very nature, is impersonal, and it's always seeking to balance, to achieve balance. It's ceaselessly seeking to achieve balance. The red pants in the back there.
We were just wondering, how do we ever question these ideals that we hold to? Are they really ours, or is it something we picked up from someone else, or something we read, and we just sort of like adopted it, but we didn't really test it for ourselves?
Oh. Okay, well, that sounds more like blind belief than that's what we're here for. We adopt it, of course. We have to adopt it and bring it home, in a sense, and try it out and see if it works. So, yeah, these ideas we hold, where do they come from? Well, they were impressed with, earlier was stated that the fathers are those, you know, those that walked the earth and instructed us in all the arts and science and philosophy, and in a sense burned it into our very being. They're the ones who lit the lighting up of Manus, that lit the flame that inspires us, that enthuses us, that keeps us going, that these ideas are alive, that words are living messengers, and they have power and potency. And so, yeah, these ideas, they don't just come from nowhere. But it's up to us to practice them. We can listen to wonderful lectures. We can watch inspirational shows on television, read good books, but if it stops there, we're lost. We're absolutely lost. It doesn't in here. The word in here, it's in here. It's got to be in here. It's basic. Yes, over there.
In Rome, there's a beautiful statue of white marble called the Pietà. It shows a young, beautiful statue of a female, and lying asleep in her lap is a male figure. And she says to it, beautiful dreamer, awake unto me. And with music about
Yes, well, we believe the statue is of the Blessed Mother and the crucified, her son, the crucified Christ. So we don't think he's asleep at this point, but we have to, the crucified Christ, that's what we're doing every day when we're acting against a higher nature. We're crucifying the Christ within us. And we are to rise above that. We're to rise above that. Yes.
On the idea of ideas, none of us have, all the ideas that we hold, we've gotten from someplace else. Our parents impressed us at the earliest days, right after birth. We're in a home that their psychic nature is, is all around us, and they're making impressions. And those early years are paramount in our life, because many times in our older age we see things that we don't understand where they came from. That they came from impressions that we had, and that even here we come and these ideas aren't ours. They've been given to us for the first time. We are told that we can check, test, and verify to see if they are the truth. And again, as Napart said, that you build upon what's true. You did build, what do you know is true? Then build upon that. And, ideas are things that we're asked to give to the world, like reincarnation, karma.
We're here to spread, broadcast these ideas because the world is sorely in need of these ideas. It's the missing chord of Christianity. It's reincarnation, but it's really karma, the law. Reincarnation is the merciful act. There's justice and mercy. Reincarnation is merciful because we get as many chances as we need up to a point. But we get thousands and thousands of chances to correct our mistakes. This is interesting too. At the bottom of page 2, it talks about if we are anxious, we raise a barrier against process. And also by perturbation and straining harshly. So we think that we're told to wear life as a loose garment and to not be anxious. Don't raise barriers against our process. We're doing that ourselves. When we're anxious and nervous, and what are we nervous about? That we'll look foolish or stupid so we need to get over ourselves. We need to get over that part so that we're not anxious and we don't create our own barriers and our own obstacles. I'm sure we've all known people who are their own worst enemy. And we can just see, It's like, it just seems like they're born losers, but they're not born losers, really. But they keep raising the barriers to their own success. But they seem that way. They seem that way, but they're not. They're not, because we know that we're... Okay, that's enough of that. We're not being despondent enough here. We're despairing. I'm starting to laugh. Yes.
Some of those behaviors you speak of, I think we, we talk of, about the things in here, but then you go outside and turn the TV on and then you hit with something else. And a lot of stuff, I believe, over the years, are just hardwired into our brain.
Yeah.
So a lot of the behavior, we don't understand why we do a lot of things, because we're not even, I don't think we're conscious of a lot of, we're not conscious of why we do it.
But we're not, right, we're not conscious of it. We blindside ourselves, and it takes, sometimes it just takes a little thing, a word or a phrase or an action. Often it can happen while driving, if those of us who drive, or don't even need to drive. It could be a pedestrian, a bicyclist. People can cut you off, or like they feel that they own the road, and what are you doing there? Like, that's my space. There's a hand in the back. And yes, you, sir.
The idea of despair kind of hits home, because if you look at humanity like a child on a path, it hasn't reached maturity. It is in a childish state. And its biggest problem is dealing with not what it needs, but what it wants. And the denial of what it wants is what creates the despair in its existence. What it needs, it just pays no attention to whatsoever. But what it wants, in fact, the beginning of the Gita, it's what Arjuna wants, not what he needs. He doesn't want to have to fight these forces against him. He wants nothing to do with that, but he needs to do it. And this is the idea that confronts humanity at this particular point in its evolution, what it needs and what it wants.
Right, with separating needs from wants, it's because we're always being stimulated artificially that you gotta have this, you gotta have that, you won't be whole if you don't have it. It's we're being overstimulated, it's hard. But this is the antidote right here. That and you know, don't watch, we won't say don't watch TV at all, but don't watch it all day long, because it'll just, you know, it'll make you crazy. Yes.
Well, again, this is what the Gita talks about as far as mindfulness. You know, to watch our feelings, watch our thoughts, watch them.
Right.
You know, just begin somewhere and just watch them. That's the discipline. That's the only thing that you can control is yourself. And you can't do that unless you're aware of what you're doing. And the only way you're going to be aware is if you watch yourself. You watch, you become the watcher. And, you know, I mean, that's what a monk does. That's what a disciple does. That's what, you know, it's mindfulness. But it's not mindfulness of what's out here. It's mindfulness of yourself. Your breathing, your thinking, everything.
Yes, we need to watch ourselves internally and externally. Our environment can set ourselves off, and we realize that we're asleep. We're not watching ourselves. We're not paying attention. So we get reminded many times of that. We do need to watch the hour, because it's come to the end of the hour for the meeting today. So we want to remind you that we have another letter next week. I believe it's on the usher's table. You can read it in advance. It's called Coping with Doubt. Meeting is adjourned.
I doubt it.